This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. After President Barack Obama ended the U.S.'s long-held policy of giving Cuban immigrants special status, migration from Cuba has slowed down to a trickle. Obama's warming of U.S. relations with Cuba was hailed by many as a positive step toward ending the embargo and hostility from the world's superpower against a tiny communist nation. The changes come at the same time as Google is setting up its first internet servers in Cuba, half a year after the death of Cuba's revolutionary leader Fidel Castro. Cuba has had an outsized influence on the world stage compared to its size and population. The sheer moral force of Cuba's revolution has both inspired and angered heads of state and individuals for decades now. My guest is Margaret Randall. She's the author of dozens of books of poetry and prose, including Ay de Santa Maria, Cuban Revolutionary, She Led by Transgression, and Che on My Mind. She is also the editor of Only the Road, Solo el Camino, 8 decades of Cuban poetry. She joins me to discuss her new book called Exporting Revolution, Cuba's Global Solidarity. Welcome to the program, Margaret.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about what it is that has captured all these years, both the, as I said, the sort of positive reactions to Cuba's revolutionary path, but also the negative reactions. This, in on the world stage, should be, you would think, a country that just wouldn't matter much to the world's superpowers. But of course, it is known throughout the world. Its history is known, it's hailed, and it has sparked so many strong reactions. Why is that?
I think the main reason is that, you know, people are educated to believe that the big, powerful countries, the United States, Russia, China, and perhaps just as much the Western European countries, France, England, and so forth, the countries with colonialist pasts sort of have a right to occupy the world stage. And a lot of people just don't expect an audacious act like the Cuban Revolution from a small country like Cuba to be successful. And it was successful 57 years ago. It still lives, changed, of course, and with problems and so forth. But there it is, you know, 90 miles from the U.S. coastline. And I think that just sort of surprises people. It encourages some people. It annoys others. It infuriates some. And I think that's part of Cuba's history.
Now, in your book and also through your earlier books, you are, of course, someone who has closely studied Cuba's culture, in particular the poetry that has come out of Cuba. How has Cuba used cultural means of expression, cultural paths to tell its stories to the world? How effective have those means been, those means of expression?
I think Cuba has often done a very good job culturally. It sometimes had bad moments, moments that we wish it hadn't had, moments of repression. But in general, I think that the Cuban Revolution, well, I should say that the Cuban poets and Cuban artists much predate the revolution, of course. Cuba has a rich history of art and culture, poets, theater, music, and so forth. And then I think the revolution knew how to tap into that. It's been wonderful for most of its artists and writers. It hasn't been so good for others. But I think at this point in time, the Cuban Revolution is really at a very good place with its writers and artists. There's a lot of freedom of expression. Some of the bad times have been overcome. And so I think that, you know, despite the cultural blockade, because the United States didn't only erect an economic blockade, a military blockade against Cuba, it also erected a cultural blockade. And I think Cuba has done a really good job of breaking through that blockade and not only bringing artists and writers from all over the world to this tiny island, but making the work of Cuban artists and writers known throughout the world.
How did Cuba's revolutionary leaders, of course, Fidel Castro, engage with international heads of state to foment ties with other like-minded heads of state? And how important was that? Because Cuba, despite its small size, in the early years after the revolution, was very engaged politically and militarily, not just with the Soviet Union, but in the war in Angola. How effective was that? And why did Castro consider that important?
Well, I think there's two questions there, really. How did Cuba engage with other world leaders? I think it sparked the interest of many leaders of small countries, of dependent nations, of underdeveloped nations. It showed that, you know, a small country could take a stand for its own freedom and that that could work. So that was very exciting, I think, for many other leaders of other small countries. The non-aligned nations movement was very important in the early years, especially in the early years of the revolution. So that was something that helped. Cuba was a big mover and shaker in that movement. And so I think, you know, that's been, all of that has been important. And I think as the staying power of the revolution showed that it was, you know, it wasn't going to be vanquished, it wasn't going to be put down, no matter how hard the United States tried, I think that also sparked the interest of many leaders and ordinary people throughout Latin America, throughout Africa and Asia, throughout the world, who were happy to see a country stand up for its rights, take its own road, and succeed to a certain extent.
Now, the U.S. embargo prevented Americans from traveling to Cuba. Some Americans found ways to do it. You've spent a long time in Cuba. But people from other parts of the world, of course, didn't have those same challenges getting to Cuba. So in many ways, did Cuba have a easier time telling its story to the rest of the world more so than Americans?
You know, that's an interesting question because, of course, people in the other countries and many of the other countries didn't have as hard a time. But U.S. influence shouldn't be underestimated. The United States, in issuing its blockade against Cuba all of these years, influenced a lot of other countries in its radius of control. And, for example, for many, many years, if you were a Peruvian ship, an Argentinian ship, a Chilean ship, a ship from any of the countries that the United States considered to be in its domain, so to speak, you couldn't land in Cuba because you would then not be able to land in a U.S. port for 6 months. So although it was easier for people from other countries to get to Cuba, it was also difficult for a long, long time. And many countries had to brave U.S. wrath in order to have decent relations, ordinary diplomatic relations with Cuba.
And so just as Cuban leaders were engaging with other sort of left-leaning leaders, Cuba also engaged in another kind of diplomatic approach, which is quite unique. It has a highly educated population, not just lots of poets in Cuba, but doctors. Cuba today is known for it's very skilled and highly trained doctors. It's known for having an excellent healthcare system, of course, which the U.S. could certainly learn from. But during times of natural disaster in countries around the world, this small island with a small population sends its doctors to do crucial medical work. Why does Cuba do that?
You know, that's what my new book is basically about. Yeah. The exporting the U.S. for such a long time time had this sort of phrase, Cuba was exploiting revolution. That was supposed to be something nefarious, something bad, something dangerous. The way Cuba has exported its revolution has been by sending these doctors, sending health workers, sending disaster relief teams when there was a terrible earthquake or mudslide or disaster of some kind someplace in the world. Cuba has, when the Cuban Revolution came to power in 1959, Cuba had roughly just slightly over 6,000 doctors. And 3,000 of those immediately left the country and went to the United States. So it was left with 3,000 doctors, not enough to really treat its own population. Today, Cuba has 85,000 doctors. And as you say, they're all over the world. In the first years, Cuba gave this service for free. It sent teachers, it sent doctors, it sent specialists of all kinds, simply because the Cuban Revolution believed that and believes that it should help nations that were poorer or less capable than itself. Or had less resources. Today, many of those same countries, Cuba still sends free help to a number of countries that are really poor, but it also charges salaries for countries that can afford to pay. And those countries are eager for Cuban doctors and Cuban teachers and Cuban specialists because they're so very professional and so good at what they do.
You point out in your book that more than 500,000 Cubans out of a nation of 11 million have gone on internationalist missions at some point in their lives, whether as doctors or teachers or health professionals, advisors and soldiers. That's pretty incredible. Is that a concerted effort on the part of the Cuban government? Because our impression here in the United States, if we just read mainstream media, if we just read the sort of anti-communist strain in our media, we might imagine that Cubans are all locked in this giant prison and they're all dying to come to the U.S. to escape the evil Castro regime. But in fact, 500,000 out of 11 million Cubans have traveled all over the world on these incredible missions.
Well, it's a complicated story, and I try to tell the story in a very balanced way in my book. There are still many Cubans who are leaving Cuba every month and want to come to the United States and don't love the revolution and are tired of the scarcities and shortages and so forth. That's absolutely true. But the other truth, and I think the larger truth, is that this idea of generosity, this idea of solidarity with countries and peoples poorer than oneself, has really been a principle of the Cuban Revolution. It's been the Cuban people for 57 years now, for more than half a century, have been educated in this kind of morality. And so many, many people have wanted to go on the missions and, as you say, have gone. And they've been extraordinary experiences for them, difficult, painful in many cases, but worthwhile.
So in terms of how the doctors themselves are viewed around the world, does Cuba, through its medical missions, earn that kind of reputation? Do they, are the doctors in many ways not just solving the problems on the ground and treating patients, but in a way carrying on the Cuban Revolution, if not overtly, then sort of, you know, unconsciously?
Well, I think probably consciously. You know, they the politics of this is absolutely not to talk about politics, not to convince people in other countries that the Cuban system is better or anything like that, but simply to do a job so well and so selflessly, and often go where local professionals don't want to go, that there's come to be this extraordinary respect for Cuban professionals all over the world. And I have a wonderful interview in my book with one of the doctors, the Cuban doctors who went to Africa to fight Ebola. And he actually contracted the disease there and almost died. He speaks in this interview about working with U.S. doctors on the ground and the respect that they had for each other, and how, you know, that on the ground, it's really not about the politics. It's simply about doing a good job selflessly, doing it well, doing it professionally. And I think that has earned the Cubans a tremendous reputation.
As we are ourselves in the middle of a now years-long battle over healthcare reform, what can American doctors, administrators, and politicians learn from Cuba's healthcare system in terms of how doctors are treated, trained, what they might earn, how patients fare, etc.?
They can learn a lot. You know, Cuba has an international or Latin American medical school where they give free medical training to students from all over the world. There are approximately 20,000 students studying at that school at the moment, and some 300 and something of them are from the United States, which I think few people here in this country know. Cuban medicine is preventative medicine. It's community-based medicine. So I think there are a lot of things about the model, the universal healthcare model that exists in Cuba, that that people in other countries, doctors in other countries, would do well to learn about. The salaries are not great, and that's been a bone of contention, and I think that's something that the Cubans are going to have to deal with to be more competitive. So, you know, there are questions on both sides, but I think in terms of the model, the medical model, the healthcare model, people all over the world can learn a lot from Cuba.
And so finally, let's also talk about what you think lies in the future, given the Trump presidency here in the United States. It was near the end of Obama's presidency that he, you know, visited with Raul Castro, had these historic visit to Cuba itself, you know, began the warming of relations, and the beginning of the end of the embargo changed the immigration policy towards Cubans. So much has happened in the last 6 months, including the death of Fidel Castro and the election of Donald Trump. Does all of that make us wonder whether Cuba's future is in question? Is this a time of big transition for the island?
It is a time of big transition, Sonali. And I think that your question, you know, remains to be answered. It's going to take time to see how this goes down on both sides of the divide. I've been in Cuba recently, most recently this past January. The transition is fast and furious. Cuba is opening to tourism from all over the world, as well, of course, as from the United States. Of course, what many U.S. people don't realize is that the embargo continues to exist. So that's going to have to be dealt with at some point. What the Trump administration has in store for Cuba, I wish we knew. I actually wish we knew what it had in store for our country as well. So, you know, that's just going to take some time to see how it all unravels or unfolds.
Well, Margaret, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
You're welcome, Sonali. Thank you for having me on.
My guest is Margaret Randall. She's the author of dozens of books of poetry and prose. We're talking about her latest book, Exporting Revolution, Cuba's Global Solidarity. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.